Ladies and gentlemen, this is Cassius Marcellus Clay. He's young, he's handsome.
They know it.
He's a poet, a prophet, and many people believe he'll be the next heavyweight champion of the world.
By 1975, Muhammad Ali had ascended to world icon status and arguably was the most recognizable figure of that day. This was a man who had already claimed a gold medal at the 1960 Olympics in Rome, and 4 years later would, in fact, become the heavyweight champion of the world. A man who gained added notoriety with his conversion to Islam. A man who stood by his principles in refusing army induction in Vietnam, and thus being banished from boxing for 3 years. Ali's magnetism drew the attention of many, including Tim Shanahan. Soon after they first met, this relationship evolved into morning runs together, which then developed into a close friendship that has now spanned more than 40 years and is detailed in Shanahan's newly released book, appropriately titled, Running with the Champ. With so many topics to cover, I began by asking Tim, quite simply, the circumstances that led to his initial encounter with the greatest.
1975, I was a medical product salesman in Chicago, and I was part of a nonprofit organization called Athletes for Better Education, and we were helping low-income area high school athletes who were getting scholarships but couldn't make it in school. So we were getting them tutors and getting their grades up so they could stay in school once they got their scholarship. And every month we had an awards dinner, and at that awards dinner we had celebrities or professional athletes give motivational speeches to the students. So one of my best customers, and he became a good friend too, was Dr. Charles Williams, and he happened to be Muhammad Ali's personal physician, which I didn't know at the time. He found out that I belonged to this organization and that we were having these monthly dinners, and he said, "Why don't you get Muhammad Ali to speak at one of these dinners?" And I said, "Hey, that's a good idea. How do I do that?" And he said, "I'm his personal physician, and I have his number right here." So he called him, tells Muhammad what I was about and what the organization is about, and he said, "Tell him I'll be there." I didn't even talk to him, didn't say a word. He said, "Tell him I'll be there." So the next time he came into town was when he was looking for a new home in Chicago. Dr. Williams called me and said that Muhammad is in town in Chicago, and he's going to be here for the next 3 days so he can come to your dinner. So that's how we met. I took him to the dinner. We had a fantastic speech. I mean, he was as entertaining as ever. Everybody loved him, standing ovation. They were following him out of the auditorium, wanting his autograph. But anyway, it was just a great evening. That was the first time I met him.
Now, during that initial meeting, you two talked for several hours. What were some of the topics you two discussed?
Well, the first meeting, the actual first time I met him is when I picked him up. I talked to him on the phone several times. I picked him up for the dinner. So I walk, I'm scared to death, and in the front door of his Woodlawn home in Hyde Park in Chicago, there's two glass-stained windows on both sides of the door, and you can peek in. So I rang the doorbell, and I was peeking in, and here on the top of this, I was looking downstairs, but on the top of the stairs, around the corner comes this huge figure in a beautiful robe, a beige and maroon robe with a hood. And I go, "Oh, God, there he is. He's coming downstairs." So I'm peeking in, and he looks at the front door, and I quick jerk back. And then I say, "Oh, my God, what do I call him? Do I call him Champ? Do I call him Mr. Ali? Do I just call him Ali?" And as I was saying this, he opens the door, and I go, "Oh, here we go." So I said, "Hi, Mr. Ali. My name is Tim Shanahan. I know who you are. Come on in." And that's how it started. We sat down, and just the first words out of his mouth, which relaxed me tremendously, was, "You know, I like what you're doing. You're like me. You want to help people. So anytime you need my help and anytime you want me to be there, you just give me a call." And after that, we started talking, but I said, "My God," you know, he just eased my pressure, the pressure on me of what I was going to say. And he just started the conversation, and I just answered his questions and started talking. But I have to tell you, later on, I realized that that's the way he is with everybody. I mean, I was no different than anybody else that would have come through the front door. So once he did that, then we opened up with a casual conversation. But one of the things he asked me is, "What nationality are you?" because he knew my name was Shanahan. I said, I'm Black Irish. And he goes, you don't look black. And I said, well, there's the Red Irish and the Black Irish, and that's why they call us Black Irish. I said, it has something to do with the black Muslims invading Ireland back in the 600s, and then they had intermingling of the blacks with the whites, and we became the Black Irish. And they said, after that, I just want to tell you that he remembered that story forever. And every time he introduced me to anybody, a stranger, he'd say, this guy looks white, doesn't he? And everybody said, yeah. Well, he's been passing for years. He's my cousin, Tim Shanahan. So that was how he introduced me most of the time after our first meeting. But the main thing is that it was a casual conversation. So but after that, we talked a lot about his fights and the films that he watches. And he took me upstairs. Oh, the one thing he said, look, come here, I want to show you something. And we went around the corner, and then he opened up the gate to an elevator. And he said, do you ever see an elevator in anybody's home? I said, never. I didn't even know they had elevators in private homes. And he said, well, the heavyweight champion of the world needs an elevator in his home. So he took me up to the third floor rec room, and he pulled out one of the fight films, and we watched the film, and that was the start of our friendship.
Now, you got a chance, I think, in reading the book, you got a chance to sit with him and watch the tape of the Rumble in the Jungle against George Foreman and Zaire and the rope-a-dope tactic that he used to ultimately defeat him. What insight did you get from Ali as far as his thought process in using that strategy?
Well, he had no idea that he was going to do that. In his mind, this guy was a mummy. That's what he called him. George Foreman was a big, slow mummy. And all he was going to do was dance around the ring for 15 rounds and jab and poke and win the fight on points, because he knew George Foreman was the strongest heavyweight champion in history. That's what he said. Why? Because he knocked out Joe Frazier in two rounds, knocked him down seven times, knocked out Kenny Norton in the first round, demolished both of them. And these are two of the toughest fights that Muhammad had, three times with each of them. And so the world was fearful that Muhammad would get killed in the ring with him. And his close personal friends were all concerned. And it was serious. I mean, he was an 8-1 underdog, but the underdog didn't mean a thing. It was George Foreman's punching power. Unbelievable. So he went into the ring thinking that he could stay away from those powerful punches. After the second round, the first round was really good. I mean, he had a great first round. In the middle of the second round. Then the second round starts. And in the middle of the second round, he realizes, man, I'm getting tired already in the second round. I can't do this the whole fight. So spontaneously, he said, I'm going to sit on the ropes and see if he can hurt me. Now, who would do that? I don't know. He would. He felt like he could dodge the headshots and take the body punches. So he laid on the ropes and took some punches, and he goes, hey, that doesn't hurt that bad. He said, I think I'm going to stay here for a while. And then right before the end of the round, he would jump off the ropes and start jabbing and punching right before the end of the round, so Foreman wouldn't have a chance to react. And he did that for three, four, five, six rounds. But anyway, at that time, he said, this is when I decided I was going to do the rope-a-dope. This is where it was invented, right here, at the end of the second round, when he was laying on the ropes and he realized that Foreman couldn't hurt him. Now we get into the sixth round, and before he starts, he goes, George, this is the sixth round. This is the sixth round. Foreman never went more than three or four rounds. George, this is the sixth round. We're going to go 15. How are you feeling, George? How are you feeling, George? And then he would hit him with some jabs, quick rights, maybe for 30 seconds, and then get on the ropes again. Come on, George, show me what you got. You haven't hurt me yet. I was told you were so bad. You haven't hurt me. My Aunt Coretta can punch harder than that. He said, show me something, George. That doesn't hurt. So he kept egging him on, and George kept punching harder. So there was, at the end of the sixth round, Foreman is looking like he's dead tired. He's swinging like he's as weak as hell. He doesn't have any more energy left. And Muhammad goes, that doesn't hurt, George. Is that all you got? And George turns around, and I said, what did he say, Muhammad? He goes, yep, that's about it. And he walked back to his corner, And he came off of the seventh round, and Muhammad knocked him out in the seventh round.
Ali hanging on, getting away with it. The left hand taken on the side of Ali's cheek. The left hook again on the side of the glove. Right hand by Foreman was not effective. The right uppercut did bounce the head a little bit. Punches will not hurt Ali. Ali just takes him. Protecting his face at all times, does Ali. Foreman throwing more punches now. Maybe this could be the tactic of Ali to let the man punch himself out. 30 seconds left in round 8. Very even fight. Ali, a sneaky right hand. Another sneaky right hand. This time he works over the shoulder of Foreman. It's a combination.
Friendship evolved. He began inviting you to his sparring sessions, then to his training camp in Deer Lake, Pennsylvania, where you saw his preparation for his upcoming fights. What were those like? I mean, what do you remember most about the energy and focus he put into his training?
He was an entertainer, and he never took training seriously. He always took it as a chance to meet people. Muhammad is a people person. He loves people. He wants to be around people. He always said that he never will look down on anybody who looks up to him. And there's a story just quickly about Sugar Ray Robinson. Sugar Ray Robinson was his idol, and he wanted to meet him so bad. He was fighting in New York City for the Golden Gloves. One of the trainers knew Sugar Ray Robinson and told Cassius Clay that Sugar Ray owned a restaurant 12 blocks from there, and he's there every Friday and Saturday night. And he drives a red Cadillac, and he parks it out front every time. So Friday or Saturday, you should walk up there and check out and see if you can meet him. So he walked with a friend in the rain for 12 blocks and no umbrella or anything. He was just so excited about meeting him. I got to the front of the restaurant, stood under the awning of the restaurant for, he said, about an hour. And then the red Cadillac drives up. He gets out of the car, parks, gives the keys to the parking attendant. And Muhammad had it planned what he was going to say. He was going to tell him that he was going to be the next heavyweight champion of the world. He's going to be the Olympic boxing champion. And all this in his head. And he had his pencil and paper. He told me pencil and paper, and it was probably wet from the rain. But anyway, he held it out in front of him. He said, "Mr. Robinson, my name is Cassius Clay, and I'm a Golden Gloves champion, and I'm going to go to the Olympics and become." And as he was talking, Robinson kept walking. And then as he got to the door, he opened the door and he said, "Can't you see I'm busy, kid? Not now." And he walked in, and Muhammad was crushed. And he sat on the curb in the rain and cried. He was 16 years old at the time. And at that time, he said, why does he sign? We'll get back to the training in a second, but why does he sign every autograph that people put in front of him? Why does he want to make sure that he said, people will forget what you do. They'll forget what you say, but they will never forget how you made them feel. And that was that night when Sugar Ray made him feel that way. He said he never wanted anybody else to feel the way he did that night. So as far as the training, he loved people, and he would invite them up, and there would be, maybe 100, 200 people watching every day him train, sparring with his sparring partners, and he would entertain them while he was sparring, talk like he does for promoting the fights, just hang out with them. When he went to lunch, they would come into the kitchen cabin. When he was out by the fire pit, by the fireplace, and he was listening to his ghetto blaster, his Sony cassette player, everybody would sit around him and he would entertain them. And he does it. So as far as training, it wasn't, he's up there for 6 weeks, 2 months. It wasn't 24 hours a day, 7 days a week. But when it got down to the end, and when, if it was a tough fighter, like, for instance, when he was fighting Ernie Shavers, he knew he was the hardest puncher, heavyweight puncher. He really trained hard at the end of that training session. So for about a month, every day, he was preparing to face Ernie Shavers. And I'll just tell you about the Ernie Shavers fight. That was the 15th round of the Ernie Shavers fight was the best round of Muhammad's career. It's my opinion. He took so many punches for 14 rounds. In the 15th round, I said, well, he's spent his energy. He's not that fast anymore. He's a little older. He came out in the 15th round and was punching like hell when the bell rang. And he had Shavers down. He was ready to go down like three times in the last 30 seconds. But Shavers fortunately made it to the bell. But that was a fantastic round from Muhammad.
Yeah, you mentioning him as a people person segues into my next question. In addition to being a wonderful fighter, he was also very charismatic and also displayed incredible generosity to friends and to strangers. Can you point out a time in which you were at the receiving end of his generosity?
Yeah, he was always trying to give me things. I'll give you an example with strangers. I mean, we're always with him. He always loves, when he checks into a hotel, the first thing he wants to do the next morning early, before everybody gets up at 6 or 6:30, is go out into the streets and see who's up and meet people. And just because it's not crowded, and he will spot somebody and then walk up to him and shock him. It's Muhammad Ali is walking up to me, and he starts talking to him. So he loved doing that, just to surprise people that Muhammad Ali is on the street with them. But as far as generosity, one time, well, it was 1976, we had just purchased a brand new black Cadillac Seville, a 76 Seville, and our car was stolen. And one day I came in into Muhammad's home, and I got dropped off by a friend. And he said, "Where's your car?" I said, "Oh, well, it was stolen. The brand new Cadillac Seville was stolen." I said, "Yeah, we only had it 2 months." And he said, "Well, what are you going to do now?" I said, "Well, I have to collect the insurance and try to get a new car." So he went over to the phone table where the keys were. He gave me the keys to his brand new Alfa Romeo Spider. So he said, "Take this until you get your new car." And he never asked for it back. I tried to give it back to him, and he wouldn't take it. So we still have that car. The 1976 Alfa Romeo Spider is right here in front of me in the garage.
Speaking of stories and speaking of cars, you share many great stories that even the most dedicated Ali fan doesn't know. But I think what you wrote as Ali's favorite story dealt with you and him at a luxury car dealership in Beverly Hills. Is that right?
Yeah. He had just fought, let's see, this is 1978. By the way, he bought a Rolls Royce, a Kelly Green Rolls Royce Corniche in Chicago for $88,000. And now this is 1978, 2 years later. And he had just fought Leon Spinks in New Orleans and won a heavyweight championship for the third time. And he had money. I think he got paid $8 million for that fight. And he had money. And he said, "Let's go shopping." And I said, "What do you want to shop for?" He said, "Let's go get a Rolls." So we drove down Wilshire Boulevard in his father-in-law's Cadillac, and we saw the European import dealership with a Rolls Royce in the show window. And it was a two-tone gold and beige Rolls Royce Corniche, the same one he had in Chicago. And he goes, "That looks sharp." And I said, "Yeah, and it's a convertible." His Corniche, his Chicago car was a hardtop. So he always wanted a convertible, especially in California. And driving with a top down. He wanted everybody to see him. By the way, he really loved Elvis. When he was 15 years old, he said he wanted to be Elvis. And when Elvis bought his mother a pink Cadillac with his first paycheck, Muhammad promised himself, when I become famous and I have money, I'm going to buy my mama a pink Cadillac too. And it's exactly what he did in 1962. His first paycheck from a pro fight was $8,000. And at that time, a Cadillac cost, I think, $5,500 for a new Cadillac in 1962. And he bought it and gave it to his mother. And I have a photo of him giving it to his mother. It's a great shot. I could get your email address and send you a lot of photos. But anyway, getting back to the Rolls Royce. So now we see it. We walk into the dealership, and all the salesmen, they're frozen. They just freeze. Is this Muhammad Ali coming in? So nobody approaches him. We go to the car, and the car's open. He gets in. He sees that the first thing he sees, it's got a phone. That's the first car phone he's ever seen. It's got a phone. And he picked it up, and he can dial right here from the car. That's great. And then it had a cassette player, too. He needed a very good sound system in his car. We love the same music. That's another reason we bonded. Is I loved Motown. Smokey Robinson was my favorite, and so Muhammad's too. He loved falsetto voices. I had a falsetto voice. I knew all the lyrics to the song, so when we were cruising along Pacific Coast Highway in Santa Monica with the top down, I was singing them the songs, and he always tell me which song to sing. So we get in the car, and the guy comes over and says, "Can I help you, Mr. Ali?" And he goes, "Yeah, I want to buy this car right away, after like 3 minutes. How much horsepower does it have? How fast can it go?" He said, "Does this phone work? Can I use it right now?" And he goes, I'm going to buy this car." He said, "Open up the, by the way, they had just put it on the showroom floor, and the ramps were still there. So the windows were closed, but the ramps were still there. So Muhammad said, "Open those windows. I want to take this for a test ride." "Mr. Ali, we can't do that. We have to make arrangements for the paperwork." And he goes, "Here's my lawyer's card, Mike Finner. Here's my lawyer's card. He said he approves all of my purchases. Give him a call." And he looked at the card, and he goes, "Well, I have to get the manager." And as soon as the manager heard, he came over and said, "Open the windows. Let him take it for a test ride." So the manager had everybody hustling around, opening the windows. We drove off. Took it for a test ride, looking for Elvis Presley's home and Mike Douglas. We knew where they were, and we went up into the Beverly Hills of the hills and looked for these different homes, and then we drove back, and we didn't go back to the dealership. We went back to the house, and so he kept the car, and he goes, "We got to take this for a test ride." He said, let's go visit Travolta in Santa Barbara tomorrow." And we did. So that was his first, actually, test ride, is driving to Santa Barbara to meet John Travolta.
I'm curious, knowing Ali's relationship with Howard Cosell, did you get to meet Cosell as well?
Yes. That was a peculiar relationship. You never knew if he was serious because, he was always jabbing him, and he was always making fun of him and joking with him.
"Are you taking Zora Foley too lightly?"
"Why would you say that?"
"Because every indication has been that you're confident that you can beat Zora."
"I'm confident I can whip all of them. This ain't nothing new. My image is being confident. What you trying to make it look like something new for? I'm always confident I can whip all of them."
"You're being extremely truculent."
"Whatever truculent means, if that's good, I'm that."
But seriously, I really believe that, Muhammad loved Cosell, but it was such an awkward relationship that he never got warm to him. I mean, he didn't warm up to him. He kept him at a distance, and he did it on purpose because he knew that this was entertaining to people, and he never wanted to get too close to him. But Cosell, just like George Foreman, he idolized Muhammad. He thought he was the greatest person in the world. He called him one of the greatest human beings that he's ever known. And but Cosell is a sincere, he's and when you saw him on Monday Night Football, you could tell what kind of character he was. He's full of himself and likes to brag and likes to brag how smart he is. And Muhammad plays on that. He loves that type of personality to make fun of or to play with.
Yeah, they were perfect for each other, and as you said, very entertaining. As far as his action in the ring, do you think the loss, you mentioned the victory against Leon Spinks to get the heavyweight championship, but the loss to Leon Spinks in 1978, 7 months earlier, in which he relinquished the world heavyweight title, to an opponent he really underestimated at that time, was that, in your opinion, his biggest disappointment in the ring?
Yes, absolutely. After the fight, I was in the locker room and on his stool with his head bent over and crying. And everybody was staying away from him, not saying anything. You know, nobody sends anything. He used to say that all the time. In the front door, somebody opens the door, and in bursts Michael Dokes. Michael Dokes was his sparring partner in Deer Lake, and he always warned him about, you know, training seriously for this guy. He said, "Muhammad, you're the heavyweight champion of the world. You're the greatest heavyweight of all time. You're going to ruin it." He said, "All the people that look up to you are going to be so disappointed if you have to lose to this light heavyweight." He called him a punk. "This light heavyweight punk. He doesn't deserve to be in the ring with you. And you're not training hard enough. And I just fear that this guy is going to beat you because you don't train hard enough." After the fight, Dokes comes in crying like he was just sobbing. I told you you weren't training hard enough. Now look what you've done. You've let this bastard take away your championship. All the people that depended on you, all the people that look up to you, they're so disappointed." And boy, you know, everybody was crying in the room after that.
Conversely, winning the rematch 7 months later to reclaim the heavyweight championship for the third time, a record, was that his most satisfying win, at least during the time you knew him?
To me, of course, during the time I knew him, that was the most satisfying. But I was with him right after the Thrill in Manila. I was with him with the third Norton fight, with Shavers, with Evangelista, I think Shavers was probably the biggest one. Yes, I know for sure that he felt, like everybody else did, that was his last fight. I mean, he seriously believed that was his last fight, and what a way to go out.
There you have it. A unanimous decision for Muhammad Ali, his 59th professional bout over a span of 18 years, his 24th title defense. And Muhammad again proves that the body can do it and that you can refute the old axiom in the heavyweight division that they never come back. But Ali has proved it once more.
And so it is here at ringside, assuming that I am still on mic, as Muhammad Ali is taken away by his group and Leon Spinks, in the most gentlemanly manner possible, congratulated. It's been as extraordinary an evening as I've ever encountered, the wildest scene I have ever witnessed, and on balance, one of the most exceptional fights I have ever seen waged. Admitting that Leon Spinks is young and not a great fighter, Ali proved equal to the occasion. And he fought his fight, he fought it his way. He's the first ever to have won the crown three times. He remains, I suppose, forever young.
And he actually retired and made a European retirement tour all through Europe. And at the time, he was, very determined to stay retired. I mean, we had an organization called World Foundation, World Organization for Rights, Liberty, and Dignity, that we set up for him. And he was going to be the CEO, and it was a nonprofit organization that was going to help all third world countries. We had 62 countries signed up, 55 celebrities were going to give free service to the organization. Everything was set up, and we were ready to do this. And we got the tax-free status from the government, and all of a sudden he gets a call from Don King, and he said, "Champ, I got a fight for you." He goes, "I got a fight for $8 million. I thought the $8 million was from the previous fight, but it was $6 million. No, this one for sure was $8 million. Can you believe that? You get $8 million to fight Larry Holmes." you can beat Larry Holmes. He was your sparring partner. So then he started thinking. And that was doomsday. That call was the turning point for him. And he started thinking every day about fighting again and about, you know, the money was very important to him. He's a guy that loves money, but gives it away like crazy. I mean, he gives it to anybody and everybody that needs it. If somebody needs money, like Bundini Brown, when Bundini would need money, he would just come in, give him a sob story, start crying, and to shut him up and stop him crying, he would give him the money. But he really didn't value money like he should, and that's why he really didn't get the right management until late, and he wasn't concerned about it. But yeah, I think he went back mainly for the money on that fight.
Yeah, not only the loss to Larry Holmes, but also in his last fight, the loss to Trevor Burbick before officially retiring. What were your feelings about his decision to return to the ring, and were you able to express those feelings to him in any way?
Everybody was against it. I mean, not everybody. I mean, like Bundini and Youngblood and Jerry and, you know, there's about five guys that wanted to stay on and be a hanger-on and make some money with every fight. But he told me that he would give Veronica and I 2 hours, I think he said 2 hours. I'll give you 2 hours to talk me out of going back to fighting. So the night before he was leaving for Deer Lake, Veronica and I spent from 9 o'clock to 11 o'clock in his office trying to talk him out of fighting again. We gave him all kinds of reasons. But when Muhammad makes up his mind, nobody changes it. So we knew we were going through the motions, and he knew it. But just to appease us, we did it. And he left the next morning at 7 a.m. to Deer Lake. Before he left, he said, are you coming by tomorrow? This was at 11 o'clock at night. I said, Muhammad, I'm not going to condone this. I mean, if you want to do this, this is up to you. And then he said, if you're not for me, you're against me. I don't want you in Deer Lake. And then he left the next morning.
His post-boxing career has been ravaged, unfortunately, with his battle with Parkinson's disease. Tim, was there a time when you first started to notice an onset of Parkinson's?
After the Thriller in Manila, the Joe Frazier fight, the number three, so it was Frazier, Ali Frazier 3, I noticed a marked change in his speech and his gait, you know, when he walked. It wasn't pronounced. It was like maybe once a week or something that you would see it. But the first time I saw it after that fight, I told Muhammad. I said, "Are you still okay after that fight?" And he goes, "I died in the ring that night." And this was about 2 weeks after the fight. So I said, "Well, you know, you should get a checkup." And he already had one, but I thought he should get another one. But he never went to the hospital. UCLA, we were setting up an appointment at UCLA, and he never went. But that was the first time, so that was 1975. And after that, at the third Norton fight, I saw another change. So, he always tells me, I said, do you think, you know, the fighting, staying on until fighting Larry Holmes, you know, do you think that was what caused it? And he said, no, that's not what caused it. What caused it was my thousands of hours in the training ring with sparring partners who I let hit on me every time I trained with them. I wanted to feel if I could withstand punches because I was slower and I couldn't get away from them. So I had to find out how I was going to withstand the punches. And he said I got hit thousands of more times in the head during those sparring sessions. So he said that contributed to it. A British radio talk show host asked Muhammad, Muhammad, do you think that boxing caused your brain damage and Parkinson's? He goes, it could have. He said, if I hit you one good shot to the head, you have brain damage too. And that was how he answered it. But he believes that it's contributed to the Parkinson's. The UCLA doctor said it could have contributed, but Muhammad knows it did.
Moving on to the present day, what is your current frequency of contact with him, and how is he doing now?
I call him every week. I see him probably once every 2 months. I used to see him every month before I retired. I had Arizona as part of my territory, my sales territory, so I saw him a lot, maybe three or four times a month when I was working, but since 2013, I see him about once a month, but I call him every week, and of course, he isn't getting better, and when I talk to him, he's not talking anymore. He used to have good days and bad days where in the morning, when the drugs wore off, you know, he had to take his drugs all day, and when the drugs wore off in the morning, he was much more alert and had more energy. So in the morning, between 8 and 12 in the morning, that was the best time to call him. And there were times when I called him where it sounded like it was 30 years ago. He was alert, asking questions, responding, and those days made me feel good. I said, man, he's getting better. Then the next day, he was on his medications, and he was back to slowness. So right now, the last few times that I called him, I'll tell him stories. Every time I call him, I tell him different stories, just like in the book. When I told him I was going to write a book, I said, Mom, I'm going to write a book about our friendship. What do you think of that? He goes, ugh. And then I said, I'm going to tell these stories like these, like the ones I've been talking to you all about when I call you, like this one. So I told him three or four stories. And then I said, what do you think? You got a good memory. And that was it. That was his blessing for me to do the book. But as far as what he says today, he says little. And he'll just say, I said, Mom, do you remember that?
Yeah.
Are you listening?
Yeah.
That's all he does. That's all he says. He does. He used to say three or four words, but now it's down to yeah. So he understands and he knows what's going on. He understands everything. It's just that I ask him, you have no energy. He said it takes him twice as much energy to answer a question when he had the Parkinson's over the years. And rather than interrupt the person talking and have them try to understand him, he would just let them talk and respond with a nod or something because he knew that he would distract the person talking. What he told me once that, the UCLA doctors told me I had 10 to 15 years to live back in 1986. It's 2006. Shanahan, it's 2006. And I'm still in the fight. I shocked the world again. And that's basically what I feel. I mean, it's 30 years now that he's lived with Parkinson's. And he says God tests him every morning and that he wakes up. And every day he passes the test. He's a firm believer in God having a tabulation on each individual. He says God is keeping track. And he says he's keeping track on all the good things I do in my life. And he's also keeping track of all the bad things. When I die, I want to make sure I have more good things on my side of the table than bad. And that's how he looks at life.
That's great to hear his positivity. Is it difficult for you, knowing his current condition, to overlook that and remember him as he was going back now four decades ago?
It's not difficult. I don't know how to describe it, but Muhammad suffers with such dignity. You know, he's a spiritual, so he's more spiritual than any person I know. He's on another spiritual level than all of us, and he is so positive-minded. When he's faced with something, and like, for instance, when he loses a fight, when he lost a fight, he took it very naturally. He took it serious. But he also took it as a sign that if you're going to succeed in life, you're going to have to lose, and then you're going to have to come back and stand up again. And every time he lost a fight, he always gave credit to the opponent. He never said it was that it was because he didn't train hard enough, because he didn't. But he didn't want to sound like he was, you know, whining that the guy beat him. But he always lost with dignity, and that's why he is suffering with Parkinson's with dignity. And he's just a great man to look up to because of that.
You know what? I can't imagine anyone fascinated by the career and life of Muhammad Ali, of which there are many, not wanting to read this book. Just wonderful insight into your friendship with one of the most transcendent athletes ever. I'm so glad you've been able to share that with us, Tim. Best of luck with the book, and thanks so much for your time.
It's my pleasure. Thanks, Brian.
All right,
bye-bye.
Have a good one.
Bye-bye. I am the king of the world.
Hold it.
I'm pretty.
Hold it. You're not that pretty.
I'm a bad man. Wait. I shook up the world.
Hold it.
I shook up the world.